Okay. Well, anyway, with that we left, and he said, well, that settles it. Went right back, packed his bag, and left for Washington that night or the next day. And there I was with that beautiful house and all that beautiful furniture and everything. And he got in on the ground floor within 2 weeks of the Social Security Administration as it was starting.
So that was 1932 or 3 then?
Yeah. And that was under Governor Wynot from New Hampshire. He helped start it. And he adored Hugh, who had worked with him when he was in that Boston office on the NRA. Remember? Roosevelt started an NRA. Well, Hugh put that over in New England. And Wynot was then governor of New Hampshire. He put him right in that Social Security Administration at the salary that he had when we were married. But it was a salary, you know. And so in due order, I got packed myself up and got down there and bought that beautiful house in Foxhall Village, just outside of Washington. And it had this top floor, and I rented it. I had 4 students move in there in no time, had all his furniture there, had his organ there. Oh, it was a beautiful home. But no ships. He went on with the Social Security, and then World War II started, and he was made head of the one of those big agencies that had to do with coal. And he had half Englishmen on it, half American. He was a howling success at that.
Now,
and then
during that period in Washington, what were you
doing?
He was
head of the before we got that house, after he went down and got started, I planted the children. I sent my son to Florida with a lovely family that wanted to take him with them. And I sent my son to a beautiful private school in Colorado, my daughter, on the edge of the Garden of the Gods. And my family lived in Colorado, see. So I got rid of the children, stored the furniture, and Hugh and I went into a boarding house in Washington for 2 years. And that's when I got my degree in public speaking.
Nice.
I'd never had a formal course in public speaking. Just this woman in London. And I went to Yeager, who was the biggest teacher. He was in the Chauncey Depew Department of Public Speaking at George Washington University. And I went back to school, and you know, it's the most invigorating, thrilling experience to have been out of school all those years and go back to school. And through this trouble of ours, I just came back to life.
What year was that you got your degree then?
That was 19... probably about 1935.
And so your children were away the whole 2 years, and you went to school. That's fantastic.
I went back to school. It was fantastic. And not only that, but this woman at this school in Colorado, she had fees were terrible. But all her students left because of the depression. She wanted to keep on going, so she took my daughter for $50 a month. Into that beautiful, she had her own horse there. Oh, it was terrific. And then she spent her holidays with my family. She's still mad at me about it because I never even went to see her. And there she was out there for 2 years. But it changed her life. They taught her how to study. She came back to Washington and got a free scholarship at the Hope Nam School that Trey teaches all their students for college work. Beautiful school. On the record she made out at that school. Children don't have to be with the parents all the time. Other people can train children. But these girls don't know that. Well, anyway.
So you got your degree then?
I got within 3 points of the degree. I actually didn't get that degree. And Yeager told me not to get a doctorate, but get out into the women's movement that was beginning to develop leadership. And that's what I did. Boy, I did a job. Well, anyway, along about, let's see, 1950 we came out here, about 1948, there was an opening in the Maritime Commission for an experienced government worker to handle the what do you call it, our American ships, money from our American ships that they get from Congress. What do you call that money?
Appropriations.
Well, it has another name. And he was put in that office under 200 employees to get all the money for our American merchant marine that has to be kept alive by our government because they can't make enough money to pay the high wages that America demands like the English do. And subsidies. He was head of the whole subsidies of our American fleet. That was the ships those women talked about. 10 years later, he was working on the subsidies of the American merchant marine.
So after you got, after you went through the speaking classes, then the children came back and you got your
house
in Washington.
Got that lovely blue home, and I got that black Negro housekeeper that ran my home. Oh, you never saw anything like it.
So during those years, that's when you began teaching here.
Yeah, from 1940, after I finished the school, to 1950, I had 10 years of teaching. And I started in with a small class of a woman, a beautiful singer for the Christian Science Church. She gave me her studio for the first class. And that's when, where's that little yellow book? Did you got that? Oh, you left that back.
No, I have it in my bag.
Well, she gave me her studio to start that class, and I had this woman that was in the women's movement, was one of the first women in the class. And from there, I went over to the Democratic headquarters, where they've got this big Democratic women's club in Washington, and I taught those. And then the Republicans took me up, and I taught classes at their headquarters. And I finally taught Pearl Mester, and I taught Mrs. Fulbright, I taught all the leading women in Washington before I got out of there.
What sort of income did you derive from that?
Well, huge. I got $45 for 8 lessons, and I had classes in the fall and classes again in the winter and often classes in the spring.
So you began to have an independent income
again?
Well,
it wasn't like his income, ever. That didn't bother me. I didn't want to work that hard.
Mm-hmm.
And my classes were all in the mornings, so that by 4 o'clock I was home seeing the children come in and so on. My daughter was there. I had a terrible time with my daughter. She became an asthmatic. That's a long story in itself. And I had a terrible time finding out, but finally found a biochemist who cured her of asthma. I have been led in the most miraculous way. I'm telling you, really. Nobody that I ever heard of had a child with a current asthmatic because she didn't get rid of it. And I found this biochemist that cured her in no time, and she never had it since.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it was great, but oh, it was a strain. It was a lot of work. And then we bought a little hideout in the Shenandoah Mountains. And for 12 years, we left Washington Friday night and didn't come back till Sunday, and that's why my husband's still alive. We got up in that hideout looking at those mountains, the sweetest little spot, right in the midst of a lot of hickey farmers, you know, regular fundamentalist hickey farmers. And they all grew our vegetables for us, and they just adored us because we brought this new world into that. They were all people that Roosevelt had kicked out of the mountains when he set up the Skyline Drive out of Washington. And all these were farm families that had lived in these horrible huts up there. They didn't even have boards on the floor. And built the Resettlement Administration with lovely little frame houses, modern little houses, just sweet little houses. And we got one of those for our hideout right in the midst of these farmers. And they came up and did my dishes for me. They sent the little girls. So I had a sink, and I just piled all the dishes in the sink, you know, Saturday and Sunday. And about 4 o'clock, I'd ring a cowbell, and 4 little girls would come tearing up the hill, and they'd wash all my dishes, wash my floor, clean everything up for 25 cents each. Just loved it, and we just loved what we learned about those hillbillies. in their lives.
Is this in West Virginia? Is that where it is?
No, it's in Virginia. The Skyline Drive is in Virginia, just 72 miles from Washington. Mm-hmm. And we had 12 years up there. We never went anywhere for holidays. We couldn't get up there fast enough. Had a little barn, and in the top of the barn I had beds, you know. And that's where I wrote my book. Where's my book? It's back there. You saw my book, but mm-hmm. you didn't take my book.
No.
It must be back there on the table somewhere. I wrote my book up there, and the greatest speech teacher of America at Wabash College had met me at the annual meeting of the Speech Association of America. And I said, none of your books are right for women, doctor. They're just, they're no good. He said, write your own book. And I said, oh! How could I write a book? Well, he said, how long have you been teaching? And I said, 10 years. Well, write down what you're teaching. June 1st, I want the first chapter. Now, all you have to do with me is give me a deadline, you know. Then I'll die to fill it. So, boys, I got that first chapter, The Conquest of Fear, to him June 1st. End of the summer, I had the old book written. And then I remembered a man that I'd known in Boston who was at Harper's. And I sent it to him, and he took it.
Now, did you spend the whole summer up there when I was writing
summer.
The book by yourself, or was your family with you?
My husband came up weekends. Oh, I was in heaven. I like being alone. I was in heaven.
What year was that?
Those 12 years.
No, the summer that you wrote the book.
Well, it was very soon after we got that hideout. Well, it was published in 1942, I think it is. Or else it's 46, so it must have been about 2 years, 1944, I'd say.
Mm-hmm.
And I was up there all alone all summer. And I just, I got up in the morning and I'd sit down at 7, and I'd write till 12. And the minute I hit that typewriter, I had no trouble with that book. It just rolled out, because I'd been teaching it, just say, for five or 10 years. But to get it published, of course, spoiled me, because I thought I'd get it in a paperback just as easy, and I haven't got any man that'll help me. But he did. He published that book right away, and I revised it twice. I've got the both of two revisions. And all the time that I taught for it, then I became the speech coach of the General Federation of Women's Clubs, and I was on their board. They have 5 million members. And for 8 years, either 8 or 10 years, I went to their annual meetings all over the United States, and I put on 4 speech workshops early in the morning, and I got the leading woman. You know, it takes a woman 25 years to be the national president. It takes a woman 10 years to be a state president. And they used to have annual meetings of 3,000 women, and I'd get 400 of those state presidents in my workshops. Oh, it was really the success of the women got so they'd come, you know, and they'd say, I've got my clock, I'm going to be down there for that workshop at 7:45 in the morning. And they were, that day just packed the place. Oh, it was wonderful teaching. Boy. Then in the end, I traveled around a lot of their states, as you saw in my record. And it was gorgeous. I just loved that teaching. It was so inspiring, because the minute you got a woman trained as a speaker, boy, they can lick the women to a finish when they're trained. There isn't any man I've ever taught can touch those women.
Then you came out to California in 1950? 50,
yeah. My husband's job with the Maritime Commission ended, and he was showing signs of health that I didn't like the looks of. And we got out here, and our biochemist, lived in Los Angeles. And we beat it to her office, and she said within a week he would have had a terrible shock, or what do you call it, stroke. She just caught him in time. And so he got the idea that he'd like to go down to Mexico. And I didn't want to go to Mexico. I hate Mexico. And I thought I didn't like the sound of it. So my sister got hold of him, and she said, now look, Hugh, you go down to Mexico by yourself. You'll never have a mince piece with Jesse down there. I couldn't speak Mexican. I'd go crazy. And so she said, you get down there and rest. and get back on your organ, which is what he needed to see. And he was a colonel in the army, so Uncle Sam paid his hotel bill and his teacher's bill, and he stayed a year, and he came back completely healed.
What did you do up
here? Wrote another book about my life. Now, I've got that book. I wrote the whole autobiography of my life, and I haven't even looked at it. I sent it to two or three publishers, and since then I've done a lot better writing. And yesterday I went through my cupboard out there, and that book's there. So what I must do now, as soon as I can, is to get that book out. It's all written. Also, the book is written called Adam's Other Wife. Now, Adam's Other Wife is the wife that Adam wants, a companion. When Adam marries a woman, he doesn't want a cook, he wants a companion. But the American woman, the minute she gets a baby, never pays any more attention to him. See? I love my baby. Now, the Englishman won't put up with that. He says to his wife, now you get a governess. I married you for companion. When I come home, I want you fresh and rested to give your time to me. See? I want that companionship. He's right. He's got to have it. A man has. And she can have the baby 2 days a week. See? But he says the rest of the time, I want you for my companion. And that's what's wrong with America. The minute a woman gets a baby, she forgets he's around. Then he has to turn to his secretary or anybody for a companionship. See? You can't take care of a baby 24 hours a day and continue to be a good companion to your husband. Can you? No, you can't do it. So, anyway, where were we?
You wrote your book then in 1950 while he was gone.
I wrote the book called Adam's Other Wife. Now, Adam's Other Wife is not the homemaker and the cook and the mother. She's his companion that he loses. In my book, I tell how she and he mustn't let that happen.
Now, you wrote 2 books in that year then?
No, Time to Speak Up I'd written before.
Now, your autobiography you wrote?
I wrote the autobiography in 1950.
And this Adam's Other Wife?
And Adam's Other Wife, I wrote, let's see now, what's this date? Let's see, where was I living when I wrote Adam's? Oh, 1967. It's a 50,000 word book. And it's well written. I rewrote it 5 times. I worked like a dog on that book. I just couldn't get anybody interested in that book. Mm-hmm. Now, my creative writing teacher, she's begging me to let her see it. And so, now that while my husband's been around and been losing his mind, I haven't been able to give a lot of time to it. Now that he's where he is, I've got to fall to now and do something about that autobiography and about that book about Adam's Other Wife. Don't you think that's a cute title?
Mm-hmm.
See, Adam's Other Wife. She's his real wife. He marries and loses.
Now, after you came out to California, did you continue to do to teach speaking to women?
I tried to, and I finally got into Mount Sac and taught there one night a week for 7 years. And then they found out how old I was, and they kicked me out. And I had big classes. I had a lot of classes with couples. I was terribly popular. I did a great job. Got a lot of very prominent people there. The Federated Club Women out here killed my book and my career. How long have you lived in California?
Since 1954.
Oh, where'd you come from?
Chicago.
Uh-huh. Well, there you are. Californians don't like people who've had careers to come out here and tell about their careers and how famous they are and what they want to do. They dislike that thoroughly. And the women, one woman especially, but the whole crowd of them, I had been out here with our national president and had put on a speech class. So I thought when I got out here, I'd just carry right on. I'd been the national. But I didn't know that this state's women were as narrow as they are. And although back east, the General Federation had said, we get no good leaders from California. We don't understand it. they watch their leaders, because the leaders from the states are the ones they're going to put into the national organization. They never found any leaders in California to put in there. And I was a babe in arms. I just plunged in, and I'd never voted before. See, Washington, you don't vote. And so I just plunged in, you know, and boys, those girls, they just killed my book and killed my whole teaching and everything.
Mm. So most of your career after you came out to California revolved around your own writing?
No, about writing, and then two other things happened. One was I found Vic Taney. You know who Vic Taney was? And for 4 years I went 3 times a week and completely strengthened my body. I'd never given any time to my body. It was flabby, my legs were flabby. And I thought, well, to heck with it. If I can't do my teaching and all, I'll just go to Vic Taney, and I work on my body. And you wouldn't believe how I revolutionized my body.
How old were you when you started going to Vic Taney?
Well, how old do you suppose I was? Let me see now, what were those years?
It must have, somewhere in your 60s.
I was still living in Pomona. Let's see. I left Pomona in 1966, and I think it was 64 we stopped, and 3 from 64 is 61.
So you were in your 70s then, when you started going to Vic Taney?
Yeah, in the 70s, yeah. Well, that wasn't anything but 70. I'm in my 80s now. But you know what? When I was 49 in Washington, I began saying, my goodness, you know, I'm getting up 50 years old, and it's terrible. And a woman came to speak to the press women in Washington, who was the editor McCall, who was over 80. And she gave this down-to-earth practical talk, woman's talk. I said, well, I didn't know you could talk like that on a public platform, over 80, and they never heard another word from me about my age. I thought, I'll fix her, I'll get to be 82. I'm never going to talk about it. But that 3 years at Vic Taney, my sister gave me she had bought a ticket and didn't use it and turned it over to me. And I went 3 times a week, and I worked on those machines, and they had a swimming pool. I adore swimming, and then Hugh and I swam all summer in Pudding Stone, too. We did this summer even. And boy, did I build up my body. I was smart at 70. That's when they all commenced to deteriorate in here, you see.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing I did, I found a new religion. And boy, I found a great religion. And my husband and I, it's in Glendale, went over twice a year, a week. And it's a very great woman from Florida. Did you ever read Many Mansions?
No.
Well, and you read Many Mansions, you'll get an idea of what it's about. She teaches the religion tied to the Bible and the teachings of Jesus, and dream interpretation, night flights, healing, all the modern things that can go with a religion. And it's a new religion for the new age. So, the dear General Federation of Women's Clubs did me a service to kick me out. And I went into this new religion. And 5 years ago, or 6 years ago, I was going to die, and I knew it. And I prayed for a spiritual leader. I said, I'm not ready to die. I have more things I need to know. And I just ran into her by accident. She just had come to California from Florida. And she saved my life, healed me, and I'm still here. She says she thinks I'm going to last quite a while yet. So maybe I'll get some of these books written. So my husband and I, and he loved it too. Very few of the husbands did, but he did. And we went over there twice a week to Glendale, to the church services and the evening services. And I don't want to put any of this into this report. And
this is the end of the initial contact interview with Jesse Haver Butler. The interview was essentially to get a broad biographical scope in order to determine the areas which would be pursued more systematically. The end of the interview
untaped consisted essentially of outlining with her the material that we would attempt to cover in the next interview. And in the course of the interview, the tape was frequently turned off as she would relate rather detailed episodes. I had attempted to keep her in the realm of very general description in this interview, and in those cases where off tape she went into great detail,